it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Okay, we're joined here today with Joshua Clover, author of the brand new book, Riot Strike Riot, also part of Communditions, which has put out a series of chat books through AK Press. Joshua, can you introduce yourself a little bit?
Yeah, hi, this is Joshua Clover. I'm a writer and a teacher and a student and always trying to figure out whether I'm an anarchist or a communist, and generally that all keeps me pretty busy.
Right. Well, let's just get into it. We wanted to have you on just because you're a very prolific writer, been around the block a few times, but also just, you know, there's so much going on that kind of needs somebody to give a little level of analysis. So just this past Friday, you know, something happened in the Senate. The tax bill was passed. It still needs to be kicked around both in the House and the Senate. But what do you think this signals as far as the trajectory of the elites? What does it mean that they seem to be kind of pulling up their stakes and preparing for a collapse? Across the board, this bill has been attacked as a handout for the wealthy and the corporations. And what do you think it means?
Well, it's certainly a very destructive bill. I guess I'm trying to be of the don't panic school of thought. Maybe that's just for my own mental health. But so the things I look for are moments to compare it to historically. And I kind of have a strange comparison, which is to Proposition 13 that passed in California in 1978, a much smaller, more limited, but still quite destructive proposition that changed the tax structure in California so that homeowners basically got to keep a lot more of their value and contribute a lot less to state funds and less for social services and education and so on. So not nearly as sweeping and as dramatic as this tax cut, which by different measures is worth $1 billion over the next, you know, 10-year time horizon or however they calculate it. But it sort of is structured the same, right? So there's a massive economic collapse in the United States around 1973, and that sets off an intensified struggle over a diminishing pool of surplus, right? And in that struggle, the more surplus diminishes, the more elites have power over what's going to come of it. And they really start fighting for it harder and harder because there's less and less, right? So people start to get more and more aggressive about trying to seize the largest percentage of it. That's the same thing that's happening here, right? We have this massive global collapse around 2007, 2008, which we really haven't recovered from. There's a decisively smaller social surplus, and you start to see greater competition for that diminishing surplus. And you get in these periods great concentrations of wealth. So it's, you know, certain corporations, Google or Facebook or whoever, seem to be making extraordinary profits in this period, which is actually a period of greatly diminished profitability. And similarly, elites, as you point out, have been very effective at seizing a larger portion, but what's really of a shrinking pie. And I'm sort of interested in that double motion and what's going to come of it. So I think it's important to understand that the thing we're seeing is not some sudden overwhelming of greed that didn't exist before. Elites have always tried to obtain as much power, and especially money power, as they can. It's just the particular conditions that we're in now structure what that looks like and how it's going to happen.
Awesome. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about that as we continue. But throughout the years, you've written and watched social movements and struggles pop off, as you mentioned, in the wake of the 2008-2007 recession. But now, almost 10 years later, in the broad strokes, what do you think has changed in terms of both capitalism and how the state responds to contain revolt?
I think we've seen an intensification of a kind of logic or strategy that was in motion for a while. You know, in the period of the big boom after World War II, the state, the elites, felt like they could spend a little bit of money and purchase the social peace, right? They were like, well, we don't want to give poor people anything, but let's give them a little in hopes that it will sort of pacify the population. And we saw things like certain civil rights concessions, the Great Society, and so on. And that really stopped happening in the 70s on into the 80s. And that set the trajectory that we're in now. So instead of carrots, as I always like to put it, we've seen a lot more sticks on the part of containing social movements. They don't get bought off in the way they used to. They just get really brutalized. And so there's different versions of that. One, the intense militarization of crowd control that we've seen across the globe, but notably in the United States, right? But also hyper-incarceration in the Black community, and these various strategies that are all sticks, right? All direct domination and no carrots, no sort of indirect domination or getting people to buy in, as it were. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. I realize that's not a cheerful thing to say, but you know, everyone should be looking around on Amazon for those good gas mask deals, because we're going to be seeing a lot more aggressive and direct repression of movements, but we're also going to see more and more movements. I have no doubt about that as well.
Do you feel like that there is, so to speak, sort of a grand vision? I mean, because people have always, in this context, written about how there's kind of like the techno, you know, authoritarian kind of future dreamed up by the big tech groups of tech capital. And then we have this kind of weird thing that Bannon is trying to construct, economic nationalism. I mean, do you feel like there's any sort of, I mean, do they even have like an end goal, or is it just, as you said, just kind of trying to get as much as they can of an increasingly shrinking pie? Like, do they see the door closing and they're just trying to like get as much shit as they can before it does? Or is this part of a bigger strategy, do you think?
That's a really good question, because I think it gets at the complexity of the moment that we're in. I mean, it's always worth remembering that there's probably competing factors within the elites, right? And I think you've just sort of named them pretty well, right? On the one hand, there's the team that sort of understands the logic of what we used to call globalization, and sort of expanding, you know, weakness of states, no borders to capital, endless global flow, right? And just wants to intensify that more and more. Like, it seems to have worked for them for a while, and like, let's do more of that. And then there's another team that sees that is running into real limits and thinks that reinstituting a state and nation-based sort of protectionist economy is the way to go. And they're fighting it out. And it's unclear to me who's winning. You know, hypothetically, Bannon was let go from the White House. It does seem like for now, the forces of staying the course of an ongoing borderless flow of capital seem to be sort of winning out the struggle, the sort of effort for an economic nationalism, or however you want to call it. It seems like that's going to be hard to pull off, and it doesn't quite have the support. I think both sides, the sense in which there is a larger vision is both sides are dimly aware, or perhaps quite specifically aware, that the mode of liberal democratic capitalism that we've been in for a long time actually can't last forever. It's premised on adding more and more people to the labor market, getting more and more people to sort of be internalized into a larger system. And that's obviously not possible anymore. We're doing the opposite. We're expelling people from the system, the system of that manages people via the wage and things like that. And people know there has to be some other social management system that doesn't depend on extending the wage further and further. And that's where we start to see these real dystopian visions of like just direct sort of cyber techno management, that because people have to be disciplined in some way, their market dependency has to be preserved, even if they have no wage. And that's the horizon at which people in the elites, but probably also people not in the elites, have to think like, that's what's coming. What is it going to look like to try and struggle in the face of that trajectory?
With that in mind, recently there seems to be a desire by some people to return to an Occupy-like movement or taking over public space, especially in the face of continued attacks by the Trump administration. Looking back on Occupy Now, what do you think it can teach us in the present moment? Does a movement of the squares type trajectory make sense in today's world?
Your questions are really ambitious. I wish I had like really good, like, here's the answer. Bing. I'm not sure I do.
Right.
And as always, like, I wanted to sort of on the one hand, on the other hand, like in the moment of Occupy, I don't know if I felt an optimism, but I did feel a kind of euphoria about the scope of efforts, things people were trying, you know, and that's waned a lot. And it's now, I think, quite easy to be cynical and to see it as a small and already sort of distant event. On the one hand, I think it's also had some real downstream effects. I remember there was a lot of people at the time, sort of classic communist types, hard leftists or whatever, who sort of poo-pooed Occupy because it was horizontal and maybe even anarchist and it didn't have a party and it didn't have organization. And I've watched those people one by one abandon that rhetoric and realize that even if Occupy can't happen again, even if there can't be a movement of the squares in the exact same way, that whatever is going to be a functional and possible social movement is not going to involve the kinds of hierarchical, centrally organized forms that they were still holding on to in 2009 or 2011. So that's been a real change in terms of what people sort of are willing to understand or recognize. But for me, that's not about like what should happen, but what can happen. The thing I always say, and I want to say this as clearly and as often as possible, is people fight where they are. That's the one truth I've come to believe in my life, is people fight where they are. So rather than saying what people should do, which I never want to engage in, I just want to try and understand where people are. And clearly where people aren't is in those massified work scenes, like the factory in which 5,000 people are employed, right? That just, we see that less and less. And more we see people distributed across a sort of broken market landscape. And so when we see gatherings in the squares, it's not so much because someone sat down and thought like that would be a good strategy. The square, that's the place. It's that sort of, you know, where people had been pushed by the restructurings of the world. And so I want to keep on being attendant to where people are being pushed by these restructurings. And in that regard, I don't think we've seen a major change between now and, you know, Occupy is only 6 years back. Change happens more slowly than that. So we're still in that situation where the vast number of the immiserated, and they're mostly not in the United States, right? But the vast number of the immiserated globally are in that space of being dependent on the market. So in the nebulous zone of the market, but not in the classic zone of conventional employment and production. So more and more we'll see struggles there. Some people are still work in, you know, in industry, in manufacture, and they'll fight there. More and more, like the fight I'm most interested in watching over the next 5 years is, this may seem small, right, is in delivery. I'm really interested in the category of delivery. I mean, like truckers, right? And people who deliver food that tech bros order in their, from their lofts. And more we've seen interesting struggles there. There's a sort of fascinating strike going on in the UK right now with this company called Deliveroo. That's sort of like Uber Eats in the US. It delivers food. Like Amazon is going to try and shift to having their own delivery service so they don't have to depend on the postal service or UPS or whatever. And that's going to be once that's in place, an amazing struggle. So those are going to be some kind of things we're going to see more and more is struggles in that sector. But I think we will also see more and more of these things that look like riots to the cops that are people who've been pushed out of the job market and into the streets and are really too miserable to let life continue the way, continue on the way it's been going, and are going to more and more start fighting back.
Well, you mentioned people fighting where they're at. You're a professor in higher education. And in the last year, much has been written in terms of the Trump administration's attack on public education, as well as the threats of tuition increasing under the new tax plan. What does the landscape for students that are entering higher education look compared to how it did when the student occupation movement broke out in 2009? Is it any different? Is it just worse? What are your thoughts?
It's worse. I'm a pessimist today. I hope this, which is to say, that moment in 2009, which we now think of as a student occupation movement, but that tends to forget how much it involved staff and teachers and was pretty cross-sectional at that time. Mm-hmm. Certainly the energy of like faculty around that has collapsed entirely, and I can't speak highly of my colleagues for the most part in this regard. They're really committed to institutional and governmental remedy, you know, appealing to the state to fund education better and things like that. And the students, I don't know, maybe it's opaque to me. I just, in the middle of teaching a class on the Black revolutionary tradition with about 65 students, and they're great students. I really like them. But it's clear to them that revolutionary traditions that don't feel that distant to many people feel very distant to them. They can't imagine anyone taking up arms in the present day to enter into struggle. And I wish they could. You know, I wish that was more available. I'm not saying that's the right thing to do. Maybe it is. But I wish it was more available as a thing people could imagine. And it feels very distant right now. Sure, what's going to happen in the university space, as we say, since, you know, more and more, it's not about how difficult things are for people who are there, though they are, but about who can't get into that space, who's excluded from that space. Mm-hmm. And I really think this dynamic, not exactly organized by, working class or not, but inclusion and exclusion at every level, like who's included in higher education, who's excluded from it, who's included in the job market, who's excluded for it, who's included in the benefits of whiteness, who's excluded from it. That dynamic of inclusion, exclusion is going to structure the rest of our lives, and it's worth thinking about very seriously.
You brought up younger students, and these are so-called Generation Y or Generation Z, I think. And that's very interesting what you're saying, that they cannot imagine a period in which people take up arms against the state. I mean, I've heard other professors say that as well, but you're saying that previous students could at least look back on past struggles, whereas these students can't, maybe because they haven't gone through them yet?
It's difficult, and I'm not very interested in sort of, you know, psychologizing them. It just feels pretty distant. You know, in this course, we started by talking about the history of the founding of ethnic studies departments in the United States, which is founded with two long strikes at San Francisco State, University of California, Berkeley. Strikes, massive building occupations, and the students were armed, right? There were guns on campus. The idea that, you know, and this was not to end capitalism. This was to demand ethnic studies programs. And they were successful, right? In some ways, although it's always a dark success when it gets recuperated back into the institution. But the idea that was the amount of force that was required to get a thing done, it's hard, I think, for people to get their minds around that right now. And I think that is something that I'm trying to be thoughtful about, and why that does feel so out of reach. Maybe it's just historically distant. When I ask the students about this, right, they're interesting and thoughtful about this. And the main thing they say is, the amount of sheer violence the state is ready to bring against you if you do anything like that is much higher now than it was in 1967. And, you know, they might be right. The state has been very, very effective at producing a sense of intense threat. You know, you ask for these, I remember 2009, right? People were making quite minor demands, like, please don't raise my tuition 34%. And the next thing you know, you have, you know, cop helicopters and police dogs snarling and for like such a minor request. And it is, you know, sort of clear that the willingness to respond with extreme violent repression is very much hovering in the air at all times. So I sort of get that. Of course, there was never a moment when fighting back was going to go unopposed. So I wonder how we get there.
Well, that kind of brings us to our next question. In the wake of the economic crisis of 2008, there was a lot of talk about how young workers, students, people in debt had, quote, no future. And this was kind of a slogan that was used at the time to describe millennial life, I guess. But, you know, in today's world, when we factor in automation, climate change, gentrification, the inability of people to kind of reproduce themselves, when you look at the current situation, what are you seeing? How do you think this should inform the way that people fight and organize? Just this kind of general immiseration, as you called it.
Yeah. Well, again, I'm going to back away from the word should. I always get in trouble when I use it. I think it will inform it. So the analysis in around the 2008 crisis that there was no future, that the massive investment of time and capacity and money into making yourself the kind of person who could have conventional success later, that door was closing. That analysis strikes me as inarguable. It takes a while for the dramatic effects of that to be felt, which is to say, it's not like the students in Greece understood that analysis better. Is that they were actually encountering what no future looked like, right? They're living on a daily basis, and thus the drama of their struggles in the streets, you know, in Greece since 2008, I think contemporary, you know, young people. I don't really want to speak for them. They probably know more about this than I do. They confront it in a way more directly than I do. They get it. I think we're in a period of people trying to adjust their sense of what kind of future is promised to them and recognizing that it looks more like survival than success and, you know, conventional bourgeois success. And you can try and attune yourself to that new situation mentally all you want. At some point, the misery of daily life is going to move you. And that's always the question for me is, when do we get to that moment? You know, the thing I thought about Occupy in the end was that there were two social fractions involved in it. And one was people who were already excluded, already immiserated, already kicked out of the job market, already treated as waste by society. And then there were people who were very much, you know, in society, but experiencing downward mobility for the first time and experiencing that foreclosure of a future. And these are different social fractions. And one of the remarkable things about Occupy is that those two groupings were able to move together for a while. It was really extraordinary. And the question is, can that happen again and be more sustained? And I think the answer is that happens when that second group, the people who are still within the logic of civil society, but downwardly mobile, when they encounter the bite of that even more intensely, it's going to be more available to them to move with, act in solidarity with those who are truly excluded. And that difference right now articulates itself in lots of different ways, notably along lines of race. But we're still waiting for that moment when the daily misery of life motivates people to take risks next year that they couldn't imagine last year.
Well, that's a really good point, and also a good analysis of Occupy, and I would definitely agree with that breakdown. Well, let's turn now to the book. You wrote a book about riots and strikes.
What's my title? You can call it whatever you want. There was not the title I gave the book, but that's how it turned out.
Okay. What was the original title?
Originally, I was given this old-fashioned title, just Of Riot, like a book a book about Riot. But the publisher the publisher hated that, and they made me call it Riot Strike Riot. And we had a big fight, and I lost the fight. I always lose fights. I can't win. So well, let's talk about that. And, right. Okay.
That's interesting, though. Well, let's talk about the book. I mean, why write a book about riots and strikes and how they affect the economy in today's world? What drove you to write that, and why do you think it's important?
Well, a lot of things. I want to try not to, you know, as a scholar, there's often this denying of the personal, and I don't want to do that. I've been part of both strikes and riots in my life. I was a very zealous labor organizer when I was young. I had did my first work trying to start a union when I was 19. And I've also, I don't know how to put this in a properly legal context. I've been near riots in my life, and seen them unfold. And I find both these phenomena very interesting. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of studies of them historically that are largely sort of sociological. What is the experience of people who engage in these things, who are drawn into these things? What is their daily life like in these times and leading up to these times? And those are many of them very important books. And I wanted to write a slightly different kind of book, which tried to provide an explanation for what's in some ways a very simple fact, which is that for a couple centuries, the riot was sort of the orienting form of social contest in the repertoire of social contest, as one famous historian calls it. And then it gets replaced by the strike in much of the world, not all of it, for a couple centuries, maybe a century and a half. And then the strike really starts to decline, as we've seen in our lifetimes. And the riot starts to return, both actual riots, but also as a fascination for individuals, politicians, movies, you know, whatever. And I wanted to be able to offer an explanation of why that happens rather than just noticing it. So it's more like a re-narration of the history of struggle within a certain framework. And that seemed important, right, for explaining why the phase we're in, which is a phase I think led by riots, is going to continue. Again, there's no should there. I'm not saying people should riot. I'm not saying people should strike. I don't see why they wouldn't, but that's me. I'm just saying they will. Like, here's what's going to happen, and here's why, without any judgment on it. And that was the goal. That was the goal of the book. And it rubbed a bunch of people the wrong way, but I guess that was maybe inevitable.
Yeah, that's interesting you bring that up. I mean, in academia, do you get pushback from other people? Because I mean, these are very quintessential proletarian actions, you know, from the ground up. Or are some people just miffed that you would even kind of valorize that or bring it up?
That certainly happens, especially if people haven't read the book and they assume the book is, it's a book of advocacy, and they're sort of like, why are you advocating riots there? And you know, people have different reasons why they don't like riots. Some people find riots intolerably bad behavior, and some people have a more paternalistic, oh, I can understand why people would do it, but it's a bad strategy, and so on. Various stances, right? But almost no one in the teaching level of academia is sort of just thinks riots are a fundamental, necessary political activity. And so there's a certain amount of pushback around that if they think it's a book of advocacy. When people read the book, they tend to sort of be a little bit more thoughtful about what the book is trying to puzzle out, which is
right.
A why, it's an is, not a should. But also, not just in academia, but I think in general, in whatever my sort of automatic social milieu is, which is middle class leftists, I don't really identify with that, right? But it's, you end up circulating in that category all the time if you're a liberal arts professor. And the preference in that group is aggressively for strikes as a strategy. They're really identified with labor organizing and why it's good and the virtues of labor. And I'm not really opposed to any of those things, although I'm certainly opposed to the ways people talk about them, and I'm certainly opposed to the way unions administer them. But the preference for the strike is incredibly strong among those people. Interestingly, they themselves generally don't belong to unions, right? So it's very weak unionization among university faculty. So they generally don't belong to unions, and yet they're very sort of pro-strike in the abstract, at least, and consequently very hostile to political action that's not labor-based. And that's definitely been a source of tension, to be sure.
Well, that kind of brings us actually to our next question. Is in chapter 8, you write, quote, "The weakness of the static model of, quote, the working class is not simply in some abstract failure to track capital's restructurings, but in the practical inattention to changes in the subject of struggle." Can you explain what you mean by this and why you think this is so? I mean, we've kind of brushed on this topic, but just kind of the language around, quote, the working class or who works and who doesn't, as you've mentioned several times in this interview, that the economy has changed much.
Yeah, that's for me a core question, maybe even the core question. So we have it, and it seems to be a language question, and it's not a language question. We have these two different terms, the working class and the proletariat. They get used largely interchangeably. There's good reason for that. Some of our greatest thinkers of those categories use them interchangeably, and so why shouldn't we? But they're quite different. What matters is they're becoming more and more different, and people are often not attentive to that. So the working class, this is a category people associate with Karl Marx and that tradition. It's not a term from Marx. It's a term developed by factory inspectors. It's a fundamentally sociological term. And it, you know, it refers to people who do a certain kind of recognizable, identifiable labor, physical labor. It comes from the 19th century. And we've tried to adapt and modify that over the course of the last 150, 200 years to sort of keep it functional. We understand that work has changed in various ways. People are doing more service work and things like that, but we're still trying to hold on to that category, right? People who go to work, they get a wage, they come home, they support some larger grouping, probably a family, using that wage and so on. Now, at the same time, we have this other problem, which is that as the economy has developed, both in the sort of early industrializing West and globally in the last couple hundred years. We've touched on this earlier, right? The capacity to internalize new labor inputs, that's a fancy way of putting it, right? But that just means the ability to add workers. It grew for a while because it was so profitable to make cars in 1910, 1920. That even though automation was coming in, the second industrial revolution and the assembly line, it was still so profitable that the sector grew and grew and add workers and add workers and add workers. But at some point that stops being the case. And I don't mean to dodge it by saying at some point, if people want to get into the real nitty gritty details, I can go there with them, but I'm not sure it's appropriate now. But a moment comes when the demand for cars or whatever, in relation to how efficient we are at producing them, the level of productivity is such that there's no need to add workers. You just have more and more productive machine-based processes, and you can crank out all those cars. You don't need those. And then you start shedding workers. So it's not just cars, right? It's the entire economy. The entire economy is shedding workers. It's been shedding workers for a while. So now you have this whole category of people. Lots of different terms get used. Surplus population is probably the most common these days. Surplus here doesn't mean surplus to our sense of the human. It means surplus to capital's needs to produce surplus value. And that population grows and grows. They're just not included under that framework, working class, right? So what are the politics of that group of people? And that's the book, right? The book is about the politics of that group of people and how that group of people is not going to strike, not because they think it's, you know, not because they think that union hierarchies are screwed, man, but because they don't work. They don't have a kind of job and a wage that allows them to strike. They're going to do something else. And that's what the riot is, right? So in understanding not just the riot strike dynamic, which is obviously the thing I try and think about, but many, many different political dynamics, it's of the first importance to keep our eyes on the widening gap between the working class and the proletariat, which includes all of those people who are proletarianized, who wake up in the morning and have to figure out how to stay alive and don't have, you know, a bunch of stuff they own to rely on. They too are the proletariat. And this is the growing portion of the proletariat. So when we think about the politics of the present, the next 10 years, the next 50 years, the next 100 years, that's who I think it's vital to think about.
Yeah, just real quick, one interjection. There's a quote from the book Poor People's Movements, Why They Succeed and How They Fail, that I've always really liked. But it says in there, I'm pointing it up now, but quote, indeed, some of the poor are sometimes so isolated from significant industrial participation that the, institutional participation that the only contribution they can withhold is that of acquiescence to civil life. They can riot.
Yeah.
Meaning the only negative sanction, the only thing they can withhold is the ability to stay passive. So
That's exactly right. And I think we've seen since that book was written, which is a really useful book, we've seen an ongoing explosion of that category of people that are being discussed there.
That's an interesting book too, because at the end they're just kind of like, yeah, this shit sucks, but you know, whatever. It's better than nothing. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
They kind of have a very pessimistic view of just the human condition, I think. But such as being a liberal, I guess.
Well, I can't really look out at the world and try and take anyone's pessimism from them. It seems like a reasonable response, but there's things you can, like, pessimism doesn't have to mean pacifism. That's the thing I always want to remind myself.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that. So going back to chapter 8, quote, two examples.
You love chapter 8.
Yeah. In chapter 8, you write, quote, two examples will be particularly suggestive in considering the current situation of riot prime in the overdeveloped world. Two landscapes, then, the square and the street. Just as the port and the factory were the space of riot and strike, respectively, these are the natural homes of riot prime. Do you see these, and we've kind of talked about these two landscapes, you know, the square being kind of like where Occupy kicked off and the street being where riots kick off. Do you see these two landscapes as kind of like the terrains that exist now in terms of how people could possibly act? And are there new ones to be discovered? And if so, what could they be potentially?
Now you're asking for an ambitious forecast. I don't know if there's new landscapes. I mean, the lessons of 2014, not new then and not unseen since then, but the lesson of 2014, right, is that it's all about the freeway, which is a version of the street. It's the late modern street. I'm fascinated by, there's some portion of maybe Highway 70 that goes through Indiana that's referred to as the Main Street of the Midwest. And you know, it's just a big freeway. And I think there's something actually beautiful about that. It's amazing how, you know, these government functionaries by accident have these moments of vision. And you know, I think we've seen the logic of the freeway as a place of political action. And I think we'll see more of that, not just freeways, but in general, that thing, you know, people like to refer to it as blocking circulation, which I think simplifies matters a little bit. I think that the structure of global capital and its logistics networks is pretty resilient, as they say. And so even if we were to block 30 freeways, there's a lot of routing around. But more and more, as I said, we're likely to see strikes in the delivery sector. We're likely to see riots, or, you know, however we want to name massive public gatherings that are not about work, in places like the freeway, the airport, places where circulation of bodies and of goods happens swiftly and constantly and suffers from being disrupted. So, you know, that I think is an easy prediction. I don't think I'm the only one to make it, but we can pretty much guarantee that there'll be a certain amount of direct politics around that kind of human and commodity flow in the next decade.
Yeah, and I mean, just with what's happened in the past couple of weeks with the blockage of the train in Olympia, definitely shows that to be true. Yeah. I'm just curious if you can talk a little bit about, you mentioned 2014, and I'm sure that you're alluding to the not only what happened in Ferguson, but also just the response across the U.S.
Yeah.
Can you just talk about why that's important as an example?
Well, probably a couple of different ways. That year had this double structure that's actually not uncommon, which is, so first there's an event where the cops kill a black person unjustly, and there are local riots that follow that immediately. And then there is the moment that happens weeks, months later, in which you discover that this murder is going to be allowed to continue with impunity, right? There's going to be no punishment for the cops. And then you tend to get, if anything, you tend to get widespread rioting. And we saw, you know, in what I refer to as Ferguson 2, when the cop, Darren Wilson, was not indicted, in November of 2014, we saw, a national wave of freeway occupations, that was pretty extraordinary. So both Ferguson 1, which is the events in Ferguson in August, and then Ferguson 2 were historically extraordinary. The first one was by some measures the longest riot in U.S. history. It went on and on. We saw for the first time in a long time, to hearken back to our earlier discussion of what can and can't be imagined these days, we saw rioters shooting back at cops. Mm-hmm. And so the length and the intensity of that was probably historically unprecedented. And then the breadth of Ferguson 2 across the country, we've seen episodes like that, certainly after the verdicts in Los Angeles in 1992. We saw a national wave of riots, 67 and 68, massive national riots, all of them premised around racial struggle and direct violence against black people. And so Ferguson 2 is not unprecedented in that sense, but that certainty that the right thing to do was to block the freeway, that's interesting, right? That is on the one hand a real historical throwback to the riots of the 17th and 18th centuries that consistently involved blocking roads to stop the transport of goods when people were starving. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, it's a throwback, but on the other hand, it's an image of the future, of the way that people are going to have to fight if they want to make the world stop. And that desire to make the world stop is not going to be repressed.
Well, that kind of brings us to our next question. And I wanted to talk about what's happened under Trump the last year, and I don't want to kind of segment, you know, everything off into just, you know, who's in power, but I think it is important to look back at the last year. My question was that I would like to talk about riots and that type of activity under Trump. And I think what's interesting about this year is that we saw a month of sustained and it wasn't just a month, it's still going on. But in St. Louis, you know, we saw a month of riotous and just rowdy protest activity. And what's interesting, I think a big question that comes out of this is, why did it not spread in that instance, but in the wake of Heather Heyer being murdered in Charlottesville, we saw just an explosion of activity, you know, weeks and weeks of people taking to the streets, physically tearing down statues, clashing with the alt-right. I'm just kind of curious, looking back at the past year, just what are your thoughts on it?
Well, the question of why does it spread sometimes and not other times, it's a greatly studied question. I don't think anyone has particularly good answers to it. Probably we want to think about, you know, memes or something like that, which is to say the ways in which things need a framework in which to spread. So that like, we can think of pulling down statues as a kind of meme, right? I'm not sure I love the language of memes, but that just might be because I'm old. But the logic of pulling down statues was really clear to people. It's like, oh, what would a response look like? Oh, it's a specific practical action. Let's go do that. Where's the statue? And that's great, right? That's a really useful framework that people can have to respond. And the question of what people do when they don't have that framework and it's more freestyle is a greater puzzle. And so, you know, do you get like someone occupies a freeway and people are like, that's a thing to do, occupy a freeway. So one might think that the job of the insurrectionary left or non-left or whatever it is to provide kinds of frameworks in which lots of people who maybe don't have a lot of experience entering into struggle with the state, struggle with capital, can plug in, as we say, and you know, there's a specific thing you can do, because that statue framework was really useful. It seemed to coalesce for people a way to express an outrage and a dissatisfaction over racial domination. But like, racial domination is so abstract for in the broadest sense, and for white people who love to either disavow it or don't have to encounter it on a daily basis, right? It's suddenly there's an object in which it's condensed. There's a statue and you can do a thing. So imagining what political action would be and what kind of frameworks people who don't already know what they want to do can have a way to act seems like an important thing to do. And that's one of the ways I think about the last year. But, you know, also, so like the people in St. Louis, they go hard. And I just want to say, like, respect to the people of St. Louis. They've gone as hard as anyone the last couple of years. And I just have so much admiration. And we always want to ask, like, why St. Louis? Why not somewhere else? And I'm not the expert of that. Like, I want, you know, my friends from St. Louis, from that scene, to tell me what it is about those conditions that have made it possible for those people to go so hard for so long with such commitment, because we want more of that and we want to understand what the conditions of possibility are for that. So I look forward to your next podcast with nothing but people from St. Louis, because we right. need, you know, we need to know.
Well, in the last chapter, you write, quote, "The coming communes will develop where both production and circulation struggles have exhausted themselves. The coming communes are likely to emerge first, not in walled cities or in communities of retreat, but in open cities where excluded from the formal economy and left adrift in circulation now stand watch over the failure of the market to provide their needs." And I to me, that seems, you know, very hopeful in many ways. And I think kind of gets to some of what we've been talking about, but just like, how do we take these kind of forms of fighting and struggle and create a different kind of way of life. But can you tell us a little more about how you think that some of these things that you're talking about in this passage might play out?
Well, I can, but I don't think it'll be the answer you want, which is a sort sure. of concrete, like, first you do this, then you do this. The thing I'm trying to think about in that moment is maybe a little counterintuitive. So when I say commune, I really don't mean what the common associations of that. I don't especially mean the Paris Commune of 1871, although that seems amazing. Nor do I mean other historical communes. There's a really interesting commune in Mexico, Morelos, around 1910-11, the Shanghai Commune, many other examples, right? I don't really mean that. And nor do I mean this thing I associate with my parents' generation of sort of back to the land movements in the 70s, right, where a bunch of people who could move to a cheap place in upstate New York and start growing their own zucchini. Like, I don't mean either of those things. I mean a specific kind of struggle, which is neither a riot or a strike. So if I can lay out the scheme briefly. So riots are struggles in circulation. They're for people who are market dependent, but not necessarily wage dependent. So that's by definition the sphere of circulation. And they're struggling in that area. Strikes are for people in, are struggles in the sphere of production. So they are wage dependent and can struggle there. Seems to describe all of capitalism, right? Production, circulation. But there's this whole third sphere we forget all the time, which is the sphere of reproduction, where you and I and everyone else who's not a capitalist has to figure out how to stay alive each day and keep their family alive. So sexual reproduction is the obvious example, but also, you know, buying food and having shelter and caring for each other and all that. And struggles that launch themselves from that sphere are what I'm calling the commune. The limit of the strike is that it's inclined to ask for more and better work, like labor wages, work conditions. Mm-hmm. And so it ends up affirming the wage relation. Mm-hmm. Certainly in this day and age, doesn't have a revolutionary horizon to speak of. And the limit of the riot is it ends up sort of affirming the market, right? Even if it gets down to looting, which is the clearest, truest, and best part of the riot, right? Still is affirming this idea that there's stores and they have commodities and we're not going to pay this time, but it still sort of affirms that existence. So the question for me is, what kind of struggle doesn't affirm either the wage or the market? And that kind of struggle I name the commune, right? So a commune is just a kind of struggle that's not demanding a wage and it's not demanding better access to consumer goods. It's not fighting for either of those things, but it's fighting to figure out how to reproduce itself socially without reference to those things. But, huge but, that's not going to be allowed to happen peacefully, right? This is where the zucchini farmer dream collapses. You get, right. You get a serious population, 1,000, 10,000, a million people saying we're not going to work for a wage and we're not going to buy in the market. We're going to start caring for ourselves. And producing our own means of reproduction, the state's going to come for you. Capital's going to come for you. And there's going to be a direct conflict, the direct antagonism. It's going to be violent. It won't start violent, right? The first thing will happen then is the state will massively increase taxes so as to force those people to have to work for a wage to pay taxes, right? And, mm-hmm. But it'll move on from there. So I want to be able to think about that category, which is the category of struggling from the space of social reproduction, entirely aware that that's going to mean direct conflict with capital and the state. And that is the horizon of revolutionary politics for me. Now, the particulars of what it looks like, I don't know. Road Warrior, Game of Thrones. Walking Dead, like all these shows are trying to figure it out, right? This is the question. In this apocalyptic scene where the organizing forces of our world, state and capital, can no longer provide the good life for people, what does the attempt to survive look like? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we need to have a better imagination than The Walking Dead, which is a Nietzschean version of that question, and we need to have a better answer, and that's why we're here, right? It's not because we know the answer, but because we're committed to getting to that answer.
Right, exactly. Well, just to end us off here, you know, one last question. This is something we've asked several people on the show, but something that I find interesting. But in this period of Trump, people fighting the far right, there's a term that's being thrown around a lot, left unity. I'm just curious about what you yourself think about this term. Is it a good or quote bad thing, or do you agree with the idea of it? Or I'm just curious your thoughts.
I guess I would want to hold on to the possibility it could mean multiple things. Historically, left unity has been, I think, incredibly destructive. And if what people mean by left unity is the kind of popular frontism that's been tried over the course of the 20th century, I would caution against aggressively as I could. I think that that has not worked out for revolutionary leftists, whether they be communists or anarchists. And they get used to provide a kind of threat as the armed wing of left liberalism, and destroyed when the moment comes. And I think it would be irresponsible to suggest to people with a revolutionary horizon that they should enter into that cheerfully or even skeptically. If there's a way to articulate a left unity which agrees as the first point of unity, no more voting, no more elections, no more feeding into liberalism, I'm open to it. I think people have to move forward together, but it's going to be a struggle to redefine what the points of unity are, and people have to be very clear about what they cannot be. And the ways it's been formulated in the last century, I think we have to be more than skeptical about. The other thing I'll say is there's unity as policy, and there's unity that happens, organically or somewhat out of necessity rather than out of a bunch of people getting together at some national hoedown and making a bunch of agreements. And I think we're going to start to see more and more, my description of Occupy, like, that's a kind of left unity, right? That moment in which a global middle class and an excluded lumpen proletariat can move together and see themselves as having the same fight, even if they're struggling to communicate. That's a kind of left unity, and I'm happy to see more and more of that developing, and it seems to me inevitable that it will develop. We just need to be very clear about what left unity can't be before we understand what it could be.
So you brought up kind of like establishing like kind of like a new line in the sand, which I think is great, against electoralism, that I feel like, indigenous militants, anarchists, autonomous communists, everybody kind of like on that side can kind of agree with. But we're seeing also in the street, kind of a coming together of particularly like groups like DSA and anarchists and stuff like that, which in many instances has been great because, people have moved together and, there's been numbers. Like just the other day in Washington, D.C., Richard Spencer tried to do a demo and, was out organized by people like with less than 24 hours, and that included both anarchists and DSA. But I mean, do you see that tension kind of coming to the fore, not only next year when there's going to be elections, but also just as DSA comes into that internal contradiction of some people wanting to become the left wing of the Democrats and some people wanting to fight capitalism?
I've been saying this for a while. I mean, there's going to be a reckoning coming for DSA. It may have already started, but it's going to confront the organization more directly when they have to take an official position on their stance on the 2020 elections. The Democrats will this time provide a candidate who's from the Bernie wing. It'll be Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris, someone like this. And the DSA is going to have a national meeting, and they're going to have to figure out their relation to Democratic Party electoralism. My guess is that they will decide as an organization to take part in the election with the usual disavowals and we're so skeptical and so on and so forth. My guess is also this will cause a split in the DSA, whether it's official or not, but it may well be official, where people who aren't interested in electoralism as a strategy break from the DSA and we see their first sectarian split. And that's going to be an interesting moment to see what happens with the people who split off and what direction they go and what kind of political tendencies can be organized at that moment with people who are already to the left of the DSA and then DSA folks who want to exit to the left, as we say. And what comes of that moment, I think, will be pretty interesting. There's already sort of a kerfuffle in this moment. I don't want to get too far into DSA inside baseball, but there's a kerfuffle in this moment where an important figure, part of the national committee, R.L. Stevens, suggested recently, this was maybe a couple weeks ago, that he thought electoralism might not be a good strategy. He thought the orienting program right now, which is Medicare for all, that's the DSA has declared that's their main sort of policy goal, that they may be able to win that with electoralism, but that the losses of committing to electoralism may be greater than that. And so it may make sense to not pursue an electoral path, even though that might mean sacrificing an immediate struggle for Medicare for all. And people went batshit. People really got angry at RL, and RL's African American, and some racist shit was said. And what's interesting, right, is that this split, on the one hand, it looks like electoralism, non-electoralism, but on the other, it also looks like a racialized split. And this makes complete sense. This makes complete sense because if you're from a community, a population, a group that has a greater, more immediate experience of immiseration, your skepticism about electoral strategy could well be stronger. And so it's really interesting that this political question is also articulating itself around contemporary racial politics. It makes complete sense, and I think it adds to our sense of what the kinds of struggles and debates we'll be seeing within the DSA in the next year or two are going to look like. And I think we're all curious to see what direction it takes.
That's a great answer. Well, in closing, anything else you want to plug? I encourage people to check out AK Press, check out the work of Commune Editions, and also the book Riot, Strike, Riot. But anything else you want to plug, or how people can check out your work or follow what you've published so far?
No, I want to plug IGD. IGD's been doing nothing but nothing but Satan's work, and I mean that in the best sense. nothing but the best, and it's become an incredibly important resource for people in the era of Trump, and we're all grateful, and so I just want to plug y'all.
Dialogues in a dialogue, walking through the fog. Maybe I'm a fraud. Try to find myself somewhere in Argentina. I think I'm back home. Sorry, had to leave you. Counting calories, got no salary. Eat a salad, dude. Unsatisfactory. Need no melody in my reality. Sipping daiquiris, no more factory. She's probably mad at me. Living unhappily, I live in malady. In a menagerie, originality, technicality. You don't believe me? Check my gallery. Personality, bleak mentality. Save the flattery, I don't need it. I got an ego, I'm pretty primo. Save your money, it's a placebo. They say make money, money, make money, money, money. But I hate money, money, hate money, money, money. If I gotta work for the man for the rest of my life, I'll probably kill myself. I'd rather live for 10 years the way that I want, instead of 70 for someone else.